today's talk is given by Dr. Anne Kemp of Atkins Global and Chair of the Association for Geographic Information. Honoured to have her here. Her talk is entitled Intelligent Decisions, Intelligent Infrastructure, the Contribution of Geospatial and BIM. Dr. Anne Kemp is a geographer who has worked in the infrastructure industry for 25 years, helping to deliver information to where it is needed to affect grounded and improved decision making. Anne is a director at Atkins who, having established a successful geospatial business, is now focused on BIM strategy and implementation. As chair of BIM4I and of IC, the Institute of Civil Engineers, BIM Action Group, Anne is working to ensure that there is joined-up thinking to deliver on the ambitions of the UK government to have all publicly funded projects working to level 2 BIM by 2016. She is part of the UK government BIM task group, helping the departments to implement BIM. And BIM, by the way, stands for Building Information Modelling. Anne has also just graduated very successfully, from an MSc in Coaching and Behavioural Change at Henley Business School, and her research focused on collaborative working across the infrastructure industry. So as always, with our diverse cross-discipline EU audience, AGI audience, I can't think of anyone better placed to speak to us about BIM than Anne.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Hi, everyone. So in the room, how many of us are geographers? And how many are engineers? How many work in BIM? Wow, most of you are BIM virgins, I guess. And how many of you are students studying at the moment? How many of you just finished? You're really good, keep going. You will make it. Okay, so today, what I'd like to share with you is some of the experiences that I've been having as a geographer and as a geospatial professional in changing my spots and becoming a fellow of BIM Strategy and Implementation at Atkins. I've just been made a fellow, which they want to acknowledge that the technical career paths within Atkins is just as important as being a business manager or a managing director. And they've made me a fellow of BIM. And they forgot that I'm a geographer and a geospatial professional, which feels quite odd. So, excuse me, hang on a minute, my roots are. And I think that illustrates just how important geospatial is to BIM. And hopefully we can talk about that and discuss that, the opportunities that you've got in much wider fields than perhaps you may have realised. And I think the engineering industry is understanding as well that they need to look in very different places to where perhaps they would traditionally have looked before. So there's a huge period of change ahead of us, which is very exciting as well, with loads and loads of opportunities for you. So hopefully today will be enlightening for you, but also useful from the point of view of thinking, well, what could I do to make a difference in my future careers? You're also going to be inflicted, I'm really sorry, from the MSc stuff and the coaching behavioural change side of things, because change management is fundamental to actually this adoption of BIM and actually the coaching behavioural change side of things is really, really important. And more and more I'm being asked to bring that into what I do in my job, not only at Atkins but for clients as well. So, just to talk about AGI for a moment, this is my second year as chair, and I think what we're passionate about actually is being able to facilitate discussion, debate, not just to ourselves, but to a much wider audience. So that's why we are talking with other institutions, collaborating with other institutions, and working with other industries as well. That's really, really important. So we're there to inform, we're also there to influence as well. So do feel that you can get involved and to help be a part of that. It's our 25th anniversary this year, so we've been running the Geo Big Five events around future cities, open, big data, BIM, asset management, and yesterday was around policy. We will have our Geo Community event in November down in Warwick. And for me, this journey over the last year of those events has been absolutely fascinating. It's actually the cross-fertilisation of all of those topics is phenomenal. And the opportunities for us as geospatial professionals is really exciting. So the output is going to be the Foresight Report, which I'm leading on bringing that together and editing. We'll be launching that in May, June of next year. So again, keep an eye on that. If you have ideas, you want to contribute, just get in touch with us because we're really eager to have people's opinions of where you think the industry is going. But again, this is really what I want to talk to you about, share with you, is the insights that we've been getting so far and where that might be going with us. So I'm going to talk to you about what we've got right now, but then where we're heading, so the whole digital future and what that means for us. Let me talk about BIM. So I'm known as BIM Queen in some circles, which makes me extremely uncomfortable. But some people would call it building information management or building information modelling. Actually, what we would say as institutional civil engineers, and now quite a few of the consultants agree with this, it's not 3D modelling, it is about managing information across the whole life cycle of an infrastructure project. So it's not just a building, it's a verb. So the construction industry embraces it, but the operations and maintenance do as well. So it's starting with the end in mind. So what is the purpose? If you're looking at it from a project point of view, what is the purpose of that project? And from a geographic point of view, what is fantastic is talking about how do you integrate it with the overall portfolio. So it might be a client portfolio, so it might be Thames Water just thinking about its portfolio. But from a UK government point of view, what we're thinking about is integrating the whole of the UK infrastructure estate. So absolute major challenges, which is really relevant to us as geographers and needs that sort of approach as we go forward. I actually like to call it now better information management, because that actually is what it is. It's all information, all data does feed into this, and it becomes massive. BIM has a huge attitude, and people don't like it. So the change management thing, it's taken, 5 years of Atkins for suddenly to catch the imagination, and for me to have actually lost control of it now because the chief executive had got to this between their teeth and now are intervening. And actually that's a bit of a pain, but it's the best thing that could possibly happen. Because we've now got their support, we've got their interest, it's very, very disruptive, but we are really making some big progress now. So thinking about information. If anybody says to me it's 3D modelling, I'll shoot them. This is about us using information intelligently. So this is not just about technology, it is absolutely about how we as people interface with information. So this is, I think, the human-computer interface is going to be a really vital part of what we need to deal with as an industry, as a GI industry. Because we need to be thinking about the information from a holistic point of view. So we're already talking about with BIM, and really that is anticipating future cities. How do we integrate the whole of our infrastructure, cities, rural, the whole thing together? How do we actually make sure that that information is available to the critical decision makers in a way that they can understand and interpret it and make smart decisions? In doing that, you're going to have to think about the different ways people think and the different ways that people can engage with technology. So when we're talking about developing information, maps for instance, is it right for us to be assuming that actually a rubberized tablet is going to be right for the guys who are working for Environment Agency, who are going to have to be digging mud out of the ditches. Are they going to understand that 3D model, augmented reality, or actually do we need to present the information in a different way? So having to think about what the audience is extremely important to us. So I was challenged to look at, well, what are the benefits of BIM? And for me, testing my logic is that actually geospatial is BIM for infrastructure, because we're actually talking about the wider geography. Actually, what does geospatial mean to work? And there's these core six elements, I think, that geospatial has always been able to offer and should be offering now to the different audience, which is after BIM. So, you know, if we're talking about level two has got to be used for all publicly funded projects by 2016 in England, and apparently Alex has told me that in Scotland that has to be by April 2017, that is a massive challenge, but also opportunities for us. Just think about all of the projects which are going to need to be delivered in this way. Yeah, it is about clarity of delivery. It's absolutely then about being able to link technical judgment, whether it be design or engineering, with the way that we present our information, instead of having a CAD technician on the side. It's about much wider access. It's about lateral thinking. It's about innovation, most certainly, but at the end of the day, it's about supporting decisions. And for the next half hour, I'm going to take each of those elements step at a time, show you some examples, and where we need to be able to think of how we would deliver that in geospatial, but within a BIM engineering speak. So there's different languages and different cultures. And what I've found is that actually I'm now finding people using geospatial thinking, this is the cleverest, smartest stuff they could ever do. And it's engineers telling me how to do basic spatial analysis, which we would have done 15 years ago. But they've never thought of doing it that way. Actually, who am I to say that that's not innovation? It is innovative because it's never been used within that context before. And that's what gets me really excited. Is I'm seeing that almost on a daily basis now. Seeing what we would take for granted in a different context. I'll just take this one. So, you know, if we're looking at, this is spatial data infrastructure, I think quite a few of us will either have been involved or certainly heard of it. You know, delivering a portal where actually you're sucking in information from different sources. Databases, they could be proprietary databases, they could be from open source, but you're bringing it into one environment where everybody can see it in the same way. And what we've found here, we've used it on the A14, the A3 Hindhead for oil and gas projects. Suddenly, all of the different disciplines, whether they be ecology, whether they be a mechanical engineer, whether they're structural, they're able to see that information and are able to share a common language and start collaborating and integrating their decisions in a much faster and a much smarter way than they had done before. So we've been doing that for years, absolutely, but this is actually what BIM is about, but in a different context, and often with different technologies than we would be used to. So it is Bentley and project-wise. It is Autodesk trying to, don't get me going on that side of things. But if we can actually be thinking how we can integrate that with what the tools we have in a geospatial context, we can make some real differences. And I'll show you some examples in a minute. Because what we've already accomplished within a geospatial world, but we're still struggling to do within a BIM world, is this tangle of different data, which then leads to different languages, different softwares, problems with interoperability, and barriers to open conversation. Because what happens here is people stop trusting each other's data. or they'll try and recreate that data. So we immediately are introducing inefficiencies where people are saying, I don't trust that data, so I'm going to recreate it. I'll redraw it, I'll resurvey it, and so they spend far too much money, and we're not able to coordinate and control the consistency and quality of the data. Certainly get multiple copies happening, and we get people actually editing things at different times in an uncoordinated way. So, you know, 4 years we've had this silo of technologies of BIM, CAD, and GIS, and people assuming that their way is the best way. So, you know, for a very, very long time, I struggled at Atkins to get people to understand the power of GIS, and that if they would listen, I had so much to offer. The thing that changed was when I decided that that's my problem, not theirs. So I walked over here and I started using BIM language. Really important. If they're not understanding you, it's your problem, it's not theirs. But as humans, we very often will get frustrated and why don't you listen to me? I don't know about you, but you know, the number of times that Martin and I, my husband and I, have huge misunderstandings because we haven't listened and we haven't communicated in a clear way. And then we get frustrated and it just gets even worse. Actually, with multidisciplinary projects, a lot of the bust ups can get sorted out if you have this common information board. This is absolutely the essence of BIM. Having a common information portal which is controlled. So you can trust the data, it's consistent and it's coordinated. So people are not editing it in simultaneously. And I'll show you the process of that. Because this is one area where, as geospatial professionals, we need to understand it and change the way that we're working. Part of the collaborative working piece is trust. And some people have said to me, actually, trust is all about data. I don't quite buy that, but it does make a big, big difference in shifting in behaviours. So, integration. Fantastic. Integrated technologies. I presented this when I was made network chair of GIS, which I converted to being integrated digital solutions. Actually, where we wanted to go all that time ago was future cities. Hey presto, now 5 years hence, so what we're talking about is future cities. I actually have a problem with future cities, and we'll come to that in a minute. But if we focus on clarity of delivery, okay, from a geospatial point of view, websites, portals. This is bulk standard stuff for us, central source of data, access to data, where we're able to overcome some of the barriers with different software requirements, etc., etc. So one example is Marine Scotland. We're pulling in from different data sets. It's a consistent and a reliable way of getting information. And a whole range of different industries source that data. But what it hasn't done is to adopt VS 1192. So this is what you need to get to know and love if you want to really move into the scene of BIM and engineering process. And what it's all about is that different disciplines work away on their own data called work in progress, and they only share that data when it's being appropriately checked, reviewed, and authorised by the right people to the other disciplines. So the other disciplines know that it's quality data, that the right qualified staff have said, yep, that's okay, I agree with that decision. You can now share that because, for instance, that road alignment is as accurate as we need it to be to now inform the ecologists to start looking at what the impact could be, for instance. And that's the way that you would proceed with your design moving into construction. Very controlled, and it's the way that from an engineering point of view you remain accountable. So if in fact there's a problem further down the line and the mistake comes apparent during construction, You absolutely know and can go back, because you archive each point in the process, who made the decision, who actually stamped approval, and who you need to go to chase to say, you know, why did you make that decision? We don't tend to do that, or we don't do that as geospatial people. That's quite tough for us to do, but it's perfectly, it is doable, but we need to change our language and be able to think about it. Now, metadata, and I've got somebody here who loves their metadata, is absolutely the way that we can solve some of this. The engineers and the BIM people haven't quite figured that out yet. So big, massive opportunities, which I'm really excited about as we move through on this, is how we can make sure that they do that better. So Crossrail, I promised that I would do examples of rail. This is an example where it is the best example of level 2 BIM in Crossrail. I think you'll all be aware, massive project in London. The accuracy that is required, and therefore the level of trust that you have to have in the data, is quite incredible. So when we have these boring machines going through London and going under Tottenham Court Road, they were going within 80 centimetres of the escalators. 80 centimetres. Yeah, so you do not want to have some cowboy doing laser scanning of tunnels and then forgetting to do a baseline survey. So the engineers have three point clouds hovering in random space and having to recommission it. That kind of isn't terribly good news. There are thousands of sensors monitoring the substance as the boring goes on. And what the engineers love, and they don't really know that their GI is going on and that this is delivering this, is they can walk in and they don't spend half the day looking at data. It's easy. So my husband, who I've always regarded as a bit of a digital Luddite, came home the first week he went on to Crossrail saying, it's fantastic. I know where everything is. I know where the data is. I know how much I can trust it. Because the metadata is, although he would quibble about perhaps how it's structured, it is there so he knows who's been responsible for it, who's signed up on it, how much he can trust it, what the status of it is. So it's made a big, big difference. The other thing which I'm really excited about is how we're converging the production of our information and our drawings with actually sound engineering judgment and design. Because we used to have the good old drawing boards, and I don't know about anybody else in the room, but I'm quite nostalgic for these days where it was actually you had a rotary pen and you worked with paper. And there was something about the way it stimulated your brain in a very different way to computers do. And there's something in this about when you're wanting to challenge your thinking and think in a different way, input different insights, change the medium or change the environment you're in so you don't get stale. Really important point, this. I do think that we need to watch it. But what was beautiful about the drawing board was everything was very transparent and open and people talked. So if you went into a room with drawing boards, it's a very different atmosphere to an office which is stuffed with desks like this. Nobody's interacting as much. They're probably doing their emails and their social media stuff, but they're kind of forgotten that rather than sending an email to the guy who's unkind to you, could be quite useful to get on the matter. Where we want to get to with BIM is this one shared version of the truth. So you've got different disciplines, different thinkers sharing that information, knowing how reliable it is, where it's come from, how it's been created, and collaborating and making better decisions because of that. What we don't want and what we do not want geospatial to become is lonely limp. So it's not integrated, it's our special, we're not going to use that horrible WIP shared process because that's kind of not our style. We don't want that. That's a massive, massive mistake for us to make. So examples which are starting to happen, M4 elevated section, you know, the engineers have actually started getting really excited about point cloud information, how they can monitor, but then how they then integrate that with sensors. And then when they're thinking about the geography, they're thinking of traffic flows and how they control the traffic flows and so forth. So really integrated with the way that they're designing and they're thinking about how to maintain that road in the future. So how can they build sensors in which gives them early warning of problems in the future so that they can actually stop the disruption that's been happening with that flyover over the past 5 odd years. Another one is, you know, again, we've been doing this forever, but the engineers are now thinking, actually, how can we get our geospatial colleagues to help us in assessing potential solar energy and Lagos? And actually, what they were also doing was, could you help us in doing Twitter screen pings so that we can find out what the demands for energy are? And these are the sorts of conversations which we really want to encourage. But if we don't let people know what we can do, that won't happen. But this integration is really, really important. I suppose I just want to go back, because there is one thing which is a threat for us as well in this, is that as the engineers and designers start to use these tools themselves, this is a bit like word processing. So, in theory, they no longer need the technician. It will be embedded in what they do. So as they build their design up in 3D, and as they become digitally enabled and intelligent, they'll start linking to the data themselves. And eventually they'll know how to work with databases and with metadata and with big data. Where does that leave us? Where does it leave the technicians? Where does it leave the CAD tech? Does it mean that CAD technicians are a dying breed? I possibly think that that's the case, is that we will have digital engineers, just as we now, or I guess all of you with your dissertations and so forth, you're doing that yourselves. Whereas when I did my PhD, actually, you know, we had people who were doing the typing for us. You know, the same thing's happening now. So we need to be mindful about where does that actually put us, where we're going. So next one is the wider, faster access to comprehensible and integrated information. And I've come to the responsibilities we have in doing this, and of course then the implications on the data. So examples we've got is, for instance, Bristol Metrobus actually doing the GIS analysis and then being able to inform the public on routing and actually relating that to demands for transport. So all the kind of things that we've done in the past, but new audiences are becoming aware of what we can do. So although we may feel threatened that our core business is disappearing, actually, as I say, now that they're understanding what the opportunities are, these things are innovative to people who we've not actually been involved with up until now. This is a website which has actually apparently gone on to PC Pro. It's looking at broadband and it's reckoned to be best practice by PC Pro. Now for me, again, it's not new this. We've done this for a long, long time. But a different audience is becoming aware of what we can do. This is the one side get perhaps most excited about now, because particularly in the engineering world, they think very left-brained. So that if anyone does do an Myers-Briggs ISTJ, so the majority of Atkins is ISTJ, and I'm an ENFP, I'm a rare breed. They are very process driven. They like to think in a certain way. They don't necessarily think in a reflective and an adaptive way. And absolutely, that's what we need to be stimulating and nudging on. So I guess what I'm saying is what I'm saying about the technician fit. So if we can get smart about thinking about human-computer interface, there is going to be massive demand for that. I can tell you that now. Big consultancies are thinking, how are we actually going to get our engineers to interface with the technology in a way which is intelligent? And that's where I think that we could actually be offering some of the solutions. So how do we present information to them where they start to think about, okay, there is a context here around the geography. So I explained to you earlier, we have to think about whole life. So actually the key benefits for any project is actually in operate and maintain. But in the infrastructure industry, a lot of focus goes into the design phase. That's where it is, that's where the money is made. What's going to happen, and what's starting to happen, is the clients are saying, actually, I want you to have a longer-term interest in our projects. So I want you to be up thinking of the end, of the operating maintenance, and I'm going to have to motivate you to do that. So I can't screw you down on price and design because BIM is supposed to make you 20% efficient, because that's not going to get you thinking intelligently and delivering on my longer term objectives. So we are already seeing projects being procured by being bought in a different way. So it is going to change business models of our industry. It's going to change the different skill, the skills that are required. And in my mind, that operate maintain is absolutely the bag of the geographers and the GI professionals. It's what we've done for a very, very long time. So I do think that we're going to see disciplines changing, multidisciplinary understanding being much, much more important. And that's going to disrupt the institutions. So I'm chair of the Institution of Civil Engineers, BIM Action Group. We are looking at how the institutions actually need to integrate, how we need to think about how career paths are going to change. And we're thinking about this within 5 years, not 10 years or 20 years' time. Because, as we know, cities are dependent on infrastructure, and we need that information to be available to us in a way which can be used and make sense. So Inspire is going to be a precursor, really, to the sort of sophistication that we're going to need to be able to support this. Because what we actually want is to have all of that information available to us, reliable, trustworthy, so that when we come to Crossrail 2 or HS2, it slips in straight off. So PAS 128 is an interesting, so that's a publicly available specification. It's a really interesting one for you to take a look at, because it's starting to look at how to make buried utility location predictable and trustworthy. And Heathrow is a really great example where the data is crap. Actually, over the last 4 years, they've got to a point where they reckon they know 70% of their buried utilities. But you can't really put a spade in the ground at Heathrow without hitting something. And they've had some mega, mega near misses. And they've had some mega incidents as well. So the one was brought up by Andy Rhodes at the launch of PAS 128 a couple of months ago, is that it would have cost them billions of pounds because they very nearly hit a high pressure oil line. And it would have gone up, I think he said 180 metres in the air. And it would have stopped Heathrow operating for at least 3 months. And that was because of the paucity of the data. So this is big, absolutely massive. And it's really important because of health and safety side of things as well. Now this is perhaps it's a horrible diagram, but again, you know, hey, we have to get used to this, because what this is representing to the engineering world is whole life cycle. So we've got, we do all of our archives, don't we? But, you know, I now feel secure and superior to you because I know what CapEx and OpEx is, and I would say that probably at least a third of you don't. So, power. Isn't it a nonsense? No, actually, CapEx is capital expenditure and OpEx is operational expenditure. But each of us as a discipline do it. And I'm doing this training on BIM at the moment at ICE, and we had somebody from Nigeria there. And boy, he gave us a hard time, because actually there was a cultural thing and an English thing. So we were HM government, and everything he was picking us up on. And afterwards he said, you should have provided me with a glossary, because he said, I said, oh, I'll do that for you. He said, that's like giving me a pill when I've already died. So I was really put in my place. But you know, he was so right. Well, what this is about is it's explaining to the engineers how we are actually going to be developing and passing information through the tiers. So the tiers, essentially, you have the master person, so the master designer, who then takes on different supply chain, different levels who need to create data. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that everybody creates data in a way that they can share, but then supports the decisions that the client has to make. Because this is where we used to make hay. We used to create as much information as we could possibly do and over-design very early on, when actually all the client needed to know was, could he possibly get a road from A to B? Just a line in the sand, you know, is that possible? What's kind of the rough order of cost? That's all he needed to know. But actually the amount of detail that people were tempted to create was astonishing. So with a building, for instance, because the software can do it in 3D, you'd be doing what's a concept design, where essentially all we need to know at the moment is that this room can take, 100 people. That's all we need to know for the moment. But because the 3D models can do it, what we often find is that the modelers create all of the chairs, it's leather, but it's actually got little nails on the sides there, and there's these the light switches, and they're going to be brass, etc., etc. So complete over-design, very inefficient. And then when the client says, oh, I've changed my mind, can we make it 200 plastic, please? You have to go back to the drawing board. This is the sort of environment that we need to get used to and be thinking of, what data would we need to create to be appropriate and to support the decision. So when I'm working through Environment Agency and Highways Agency, they've gone completely back to the drawing board and said, when we're actually going through a project, what is the critical decision I need to make? When do I need to make it? And what is the data I need to support that? And that then becomes their shopping list. So their digital shopping list is, this is what we want to buy, and we don't want to buy anything more than that. And what we're seeing is a transformation, and this is a southern water example, but it's happening in Thames Water at the moment, is they're now looking to be able to virtually design and operate their infrastructure before they put a spade in the ground. And then they can actually say to their supply chain, could you manufacture our pipes off-site so actually we can then construct faster? And can you then make sure that those parts are consistent so that we can proactively maintain our assets rather than be reactive? So we know before there's a burst that a pipe is due to be replaced, and we know what we need, what parts are, when, over the next 5-10 years cycle. That is where we're getting to. And what that is also doing, and we're thinking about also, is then when we're actually into crisis mode. So Map Action at the moment, you know, they struggle, part of their farm and activity is that there is a paucity of data. But what the principles that they are working on is absolutely fabulous from an engineering point of view, because gently as suddenly realise the importance of being able to integrate data in a location-based environment. So we actually use MapAction for doing training back at Atkins, and certainly the Institution of Civil Engineers are going to do this. Now the fifth element is how do we harness innovative technologies and more big data. And big data to me is that it is something that you need absolutely to get your heads around. The industry is going to need good data analysts, people who understand the implications of the data and how it supports decisions. So going to that in a moment, you know, photogrammetry, and I've had a team and some of them are based in Bangalore, been working on this for 20 odd years. But the way it's now being applied by engineers is now regarded as very innovative. So how you actually acquire that data, how it's then used within the life cycle of the project and not recreated is absolutely vital. So we do have a group called Survey for BIM, which is across the industry, including AGI, RICS, the Survey Association, who are trying to understand what is the data that you would survey through the life of a project. And how would you share that? How would you make sure you did it within that BS 1192 WIP to share to published such that it can be fed into BIM in the appropriate way? That is quite a challenge for surveyors because they make money by the client having to recommission the survey. And that's a challenge because what you're saying is no, that's no longer acceptable. Whether it be because of powers 1 to 8 and buried utilities, or whether it be for highways agency or for network rail and embankments, we don't want to have to go back and re-survey unless we have to. Right, big data, Crossrail again. We're doing a joint venture with Arup and Quantum Black. There are thousands of sensors, so loads and loads of data coming in. How do you analyse it? So we look at, so there's two risks. There's a risk management. We don't want the tunnels hitting escalators. That would be kind of inconvenient. And actually, how can we reduce the number of sensors that we actually need? So this is pulling in different technologies from different sectors. So this is Formula One. So, you know, they've got an array of data signals to predict if it's real time. You know, they are monitoring the driver. They know absolutely what they're doing. It's continuous. So what we've been doing is we've been looking at, well, can we detect any anomalies? You know, are they real? Is there a problem with the sensors? Can we forecast? How can we optimise our sampling? And this is absolutely linking time series with spatial stuff. So this is very, very exciting stuff. What's been happening over 2 years, we've been able to demonstrate that actually we can get much, much better risk detection. We're reckoning a 10-day warning of when problems could be happening, and we're actually optimising the amount of sensors that we're needing to put in by about 20%. And what's also happening with this stuff, and we've been talking about during some of the geo events, is, you know, as cities become more instrumented, this is going to become very, very commonplace. And the sensors are actually going to be informing us how we want the infrastructure to respond. So it will become smarter, it will become more integrated. And the interesting thing with this data, big data harvesting, and some of it is based on neuroscience as well, is that they're actually looking at, so if you want to know how this university is operating, even with the existing data, we can go in and we can analyse where there are inefficiencies and where are there problems. So for instance, they do this for the airlines at the moment. Rolls-Royce rents power by the hour, and they can tell the airlines that actually, do you know what, you shouldn't be recruiting pilots from the air forces because they put too much strain on their engines. They actually reduce the life of the engines by 2 years. And and that's using data harvesting and predictive analysis. Quite phenomenal, it should be found. So, yeah, where I came from, and the title of the talk is this decision making. How can we make sure that we're actually supporting better decision making? Again, we've been doing this for years. So this is a great example. This was site selection of nuclear sites done by DEC in 2010. And it was regarded as innovative because we had distributed offices, teams, different disciplines who hadn't been able to share conversations in the way that they did before. So we were supporting multi-criteria decision analysis, and we were able to do optioneering. So, well, actually, because the first time we screened this, we didn't find any appropriate sites, which kind of wasn't the result of DEC wanted. So we reduced some of the buffering to find out what are the implications, how close do we need to be to see for the cooling water, for instance. And being able to actually test this out and experiment with it actually got people to understand other people's perspectives in a way that they found very innovative. But for us, we would probably think it's common sense. Don't knock common sense. Somerset levels. So flooding in February this year, this is the crisis waiting to happen, which just did. And the Environment Agency are absolutely wanting this to happen. They want BIM, they want geospatial integrated with BIM now, last year, this year, because when the floods happen again, they do not want the press coverage that they had. They don't want Mr. Pickles coming in and saying, oh, you're crap. You know, they were working 24/7. A lot of very demoralised people who were potentially losing jobs because Environment Agency were having to slash their people by 20%. And that's when the floods happened, so they were all at risk. And there they were, having to respond to emergencies. So we've got a colleague on council who was also having to work on the emergency response offices in their offices in Bristol. And the challenge they had, that Somerset Levels was flooded for 3 months. And for the houses that were there, that was miserable. But there were 120 houses flooded in Somerset Levels. And what never got told clearly was at the same time, there were 198,000 houses which were protected because the investment was prioritised to them because they knew that the flood defences would have the best impact. But of course, that was never conveyed. Now, wouldn't it be kind of useful if that data, that information was available to us so that we could actually interpret it and make our own judgments, and to it had been available to the politicians? But for Environment Agency, the frustration was data isn't yet in a form ready enough to be able to be delivered to people in an appropriate way that they can understand it and make a sensible judgment. So, future cities, how's my time doing?
Okay.
Doing all right, mate? Okay, so future cities, future-proofing smart. So one of the big issues here in Glasgow, actually, sorry, a fantastic event, really, really important. And there's a lot of work going on, so future-proofing cities, the C40 cities, you know, what are the challenges we have? Well, yeah, it's definitely taking BIM to the next level. So we are, you know, although I was saying it's integrated infrastructure, you know, this is kind of level two stuff, and then going into level three, this is what they really want. This is why now government is talking to Ordnance Survey, to UCL, to some of the departments. Have they been here yet? They are now starting to talk to GI and to geography lecturers because this is what they need to crack next. So it is transforming the way we design, but also how we operate and maintain cities as well. How are we actually going to deliver on that? The problem we've got is that, you know, 21st century, we're saying, is going to be the century of cities. Rural population is going to be less than that in urban centres, and we've got some pretty mega cities growing horribly, horribly fast. So, you know, between 2000 and 2010 in Karachi, it was 80% growth. You know, these cities are going fast. 56% in Shenzhen and 48 in Lagos. And, you know, problems that they have is part of the number. So we've got real challenges. Already talked about environment agency. And the difficulty the engineers have is being able to make sure that once a decision is made, it's understood and they stand by it, and it's not railroaded. So how do we get through that? Well, it is about finding new ways of thinking how we exploit our information and how we actually respond to our services. So there are ways that we can explain to people why they should be using water in a different way. So instead of saying thou shalt, it's actually saying to them the reason why we would like you to use water in a different way is because actually we can now reduce our use and we'll be able to extend the our exploitation of resources to a greater population. So this sort of thing is that if that data wasn't available before, people couldn't respond in an intelligent way. So it is this smart thing. It's not about just the infrastructure, it's about informing people as well. And it's not just about individual technologies, it is this whole thing of having a framework. So this integration of all infrastructure. And what we're actually seeing now is that the cities are being managed in a different way, so instead of it being locked in the IT, it's actually digitally enabling the decision maker. So just as I've been talking about essentially digitally enabling an engineer, we are now having to digitally enable our chief executives and our mayors on how to actually make decisions better. So we're changing the relationship of how we work with data. It's a really important thing for us to be able to progress on. This is New South Wales, so you've seen the Glasgow examples in January. You know, this is a global phenomenon. It's not just within the UK. Let's remember that, you know, we really are looking at them being able to deliver data so that citizens are better informed and can make better decisions around timing, for instance, of their commute and distance to travel. All of this is about, you know, if you want to manage it, you need to be able to measure it. And I think this is where, you know, what we're seeing is that not only is there a reporting mechanism, it's also then being able to look at how the system is going to learn and adapt. Now, I feel uncomfortable with potentially how we're going, because we're allowing the technology to start controlling us rather than when do we need to intervene and overrule the technology. So do we want the smart city to be run by technology, or do we want it to be interacting with ourselves and just humans? I've said that before, and I think this is a really important thing that you should be thinking about and getting involved with. Because this is the way that people are thinking. Right the way across the world, there's a C40 where they're thinking about, okay, what's the city metrics? How do we want a city to perform? What's the data that they're going to need to actually measure on that and then start informing the system and responding to that? There's some good stuff coming out. So with the C40, for instance, they're looking at climate action actually informing the population so that they can start responding. But how do you do that in a way that, you know, the guys in Lagos are really going to be able to appreciate and feel empowered to make decisions? So finally, the big data side of things, to really bring this together, is that we've moved from the age of the Industrial Revolution. Last century was information. We're definitely moving to the age of knowledge now. But actually, what I would like to do is to change that to the age of wisdom, because then I think it puts us back in charge. rather than thinking of being the recipients of. So the difference is that age, knowledge age, knowledge is defined by what you can do with it, not just what it is. And that's where I think the metadata thing, you probably need to start thinking about that in a different way. There's a different aspect to it. So, as knowledge age people, you need to now be thinking not about what it is, but what can you do with it. And I think I think that is naturally a part of what, but you need to put that in a different context now, I would suggest. So, the thing about this is that change is the norm. So stability is out the window. You know, things are changing very, very fast now. So we need to get used to that. And the difficulty we've got is that people are completely inundated by information. We get hungry for it, we think that information is power, and we've forgotten that actually information is not understanding. Information is not understanding. But that's what you guys should be doing as GI professionals, as geographers, not only of helping your own understanding, but the people that you're serving. And that's the responsibility. So there's a lot of work being done on this, from a behavioural change from neuroscientists to economists, is that as soon as we get wealth of information, we get paucity of attention. So actually, I haven't spotted too many people there tweeting or picking up emails, but our mobile phones are our parent. They control us, or a lot of us. You cannot quite resist looking at it and checking it and not concentrating on the person just across the table from me who I'm supposed to be having a conversation with. My attention's gone. This is a very, very human response to technology, and the challenge we have is things like willful blindness. It's a superb book by Margaret Heffernan, who uses examples, for instance, of the stock market crash, but then of the Challenger. And the Challenger disaster, I think, is one of the big clues that we can bring in from another industry, is that when the Challenger left our atmosphere, there was data which came back in which absolutely proved that we had a problem, and that when the Challenger came back in, it was going to disrupt, it was going to disintegrate. Now, the people who were in the control room went into groupthink mode, and the guys who did spot it didn't feel empowered, felt too frightened to actually speak out and say, we have an issue here. And the technology had been programmed to not pick it up as well. So we are in danger of becoming too dependent on the technology. The technology will encourage us to go into what we could call groupthink mode. We won't feel empowered to speak up and say there's a problem here and we don't need to overrule the technology. So, we have the ability as geospatial professionals and with the data analytics to absolutely help process and visualise and synthesise meaning from this massive data. That's going to be really, really important. So spotting patterns, being able to tackle interdisciplinary problems is going to be the big challenge of the next decade. So absolutely your space. That's what we need to be able to deliver. We need to be able to do on your left-hand side, the analytic side of things, be able to visualise it, but in a way that we are supporting decisions right from the leadership through management to operations. It's really important that at all of those levels it's delivered to those people in a way that they can receive it, understand it, and overrule it as necessary. So we've talked about Crossrail and big data. This is really, really important, that we make split-second decisions already based on that link, based on intuition. And intuition can be awful, but it can also be really powerful too. So how can we make sure that all the different ways that we think we can facilitate in the delivery of our technology and our data? Because what we need to do is we do need to distill decision making to the critical subset of information. So going right back to the start of the talk, when I was talking about starting with the end of the mind of being, knowing what decision your data needs to support. With big data, what we're saying we're going to do is we are going to distill to that subset of information that we are going to give our chief executive to make his critical decision, which could actually make or break his business. Now, I don't know about you, but that is quite scary. That's a huge responsibility. Whether it's a computer who's making that decision or whether it's a human who's making that decision as the analyst. Because if you get that wrong, you're the person who is responsible for it. And I don't think that yet we've developed codes of practice to really help us on this. So I honestly think that this is going to become more and more critical to us. There's a really interesting article, you will get a PDF of this by the way, which have a look at it. It's Artificial Intelligence meets the C-suite. Now the C-suite are the chief executives. And McKinsey are really saying that the chief executives are going to be very dependent on the people who are interpreting data on their behalf, presenting it to them, visualising it to them, and they are having to trust that process and that data to base their decisions. That's so exciting for us, but it's also a huge responsibility too. So we have, with big data, the opportunity that it's not just data, it's that what we do with it. The sensors will be intelligent, it will be able to inform the infrastructure to respond in a particular way. That can be programmed, it can become artificial intelligence, but to what degree do we need to be able to see a very complex integrated infrastructure and be able to intervene and say, no, that's not right. My intuition, my gut tells me I need to overrule that. What makes a city smart? Absolutely, we want that strategic framework. We want the activities reporting back and then us being able to help learn and adapt in response to that. But one of my fears is that all the assumptions that I've been talking about with megacities and with future-proofing cities is that megacities are good. Actually, I wonder whether that's the wrong thing. Shouldn't we be thinking about, well, actually, megacities aren't really what we want. Our own country government can have much rather living in rural areas, thank you very much. But what are we doing by actually supporting and thinking about engineering as to facilitate people living in bigger and bigger cities? Shouldn't we be thinking about smarter distributed infrastructure so actually people can be living in a distributed way, actually more in touch with their environment, thinking about the civil side of things, psychological side of things, you know, religious, all of that side of things. You know, what about our soul? Are we losing our soul by supporting these future cities? So as geographers, think laterally. You know, this is the old group think going on. You know, what are we all being driven by? What are the drivers? Should we be challenging? So a number of things that I just think watch out for, just the last couple of slides now, is I haven't really talked about the open side of things, but you know, one of the big assumptions with big data is we're going to make everything open. There's one side of things where some companies are saying, well, why would we want to do that? Because information is power. But actually, you know, how are we really able to anonymize data successfully? And at what point should we not be trusting that process? At what point should we be questioning it and say, actually, no, that is definitely going too far, boundaries to my privacy? And is the way that we're doing this really informing our decisions, or is actually this taking the power for us to make decisions away from us? And you as GI professionals should be really challenging yourselves on that. So, in summary, those are absolutely the contributions of geospatial being that you should be thinking about delivering. Those are the pointers. Those are the things you are going to sell. Those are the things that people want us to be able to facilitate. So, you know, absolutely, I think that is where we're headed. I think human-computer interface is going to be extraordinarily important within 5 years and probably soon. And we can have an infrastructure which is controlling itself, or we can have an infrastructure which we are controlling. The choice is ours.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think you nailed the question for me a couple of slides back. Smart cities and the madness of the commute, or smart living? So it's an interesting question for all of us. So, on the subject of questions, over to you. Somebody out there.
Right,
okay.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what do you think the value of it might be for, say, smaller tasks that are outside of the design setting, such as integrating CAD and GIS data? Is it maybe too much of a level of complexity when you have simpler tasks such as that?
So, if we're thinking of BIM as being managing any information across a project, then we should, you know, what you're talking about, integrating CAD and GIS, that to me is better information management, however we want to do that. Now, we have this argument and this pushback within Atkins all the time. If you were saying to me, well, I want to integrate my CAD and my GIS, but I want to shortcut getting a qualified engineer to check and review that information before I actually integrate it with my GIS, I'd have a problem with that. So, you know, I think it is how we improve management of our information and make sure that it's going to be quality information. Otherwise, you would have to stamp it and say it's not been checked, reviewed, so actually I shouldn't share it. So the concept is actually quite simple. It sounds more complicated. Actually, once you visit it and bring it back to basics, it's common sense. It is actually common sense. We already know that as GI professionals, is being able to record the quality of our data and where it's come from. So actually, if we think about it in that way, it's no different to what we would do. It's just being cast in a different way. Does that help you?
Yeah.
Going back to the point you made about how engineers work, you know, they're very process driven.
It's a continuum of certainty and uncertainty and fuzzy. So that whip to share stuff isn't that it's all 100% quality, it's that it's stating what quality of it is. And fuzziness is fine, providing you've actually
defined it.
And that's part of, I think, some of the clues in PAS 128 with varied utilities, probably what we could unearth, pun kind of intended, with being able to mould and blend the geological subsurface data with utility information and then with the engineering models as well. So you know, I think where we're going with the infrastructure world in implementing BIM, and I know Alex, you're concerned about it as well, is that there's quite a lot that we need to do, but there's quite a lot of hints of how to solve that from our geospatial heritage.
We find the answer is basically two communities coming together to get it to understand each other's languages.
It is.
And the more we collaborate, the more we
start to get it.
Start to get it.
Yeah. But one of the things I found when I first started working in Atkins was that in fact, it was a geologist, an engineering geologist. In fact, he was president of the Geoscience Society, Dave Shilston. He's an absolute stickler for quality. Which in a way you could say is ironic because he knows about the challenges you've got, but boy, you had to control the data process so that it was being checked, reviewed and authorised. And so he had a real problem with the way that we manage data traditionally in the GIS environment and how it isn't checked, reviewed and authorised. And look, how do you break down the polygon so that I know and I can see who's actually created it and who's responsible for it? But actually that challenge in making me feel so uncomfortable was when I started really learning.
Chris?
Just picking up on that very last point is, you talk with Hugh about two communities coming together, but at a very pragmatic level, have you got real problems with two systems coming together? You're talking about a very effective case for what we should be doing, where we're going. But actually, you didn't say much about systems, and I do have this fear that the engineers have a set of systems and set of expectations, the GIS people have a set of systems and set of expectations, and actually, in practice, they don't talk to each other very well. The systems, that is. How do you get around that?
So, systems and standards are also two sides of things as well. So, we haven't got around it yet. It's part of the problem. So the system side of things and the system integration is a complete mare. There's this data exchange mechanism which has been specified as being part of level 2 called COBE, which is Construction Operation Information Exchange. And it's based on industry foundation client system XML. It's a spreadsheet. It is a glorified digital shopping list. It feels horribly like going back into the last century, because why aren't we using databases? But what it's been good at is, because it's a spreadsheet, then people who aren't GI people get it. They suddenly understand that, okay, so instead of delivering a book, actually, I'm breaking this down into, so I need this digital data which relates to this 3D object. And actually, I can list it in a spreadsheet and I can understand that. You know, once we've actually gone through that process with Highways Agency and they start getting, actually, then our opportunity, I think, as GI is that we then say, okay, so that needs to link with what OGC are doing and Building Smart. We need to rattle their cages and get them to collaborate. So that we do actually then find a way of exchanging information in an open way. So we break down these barriers. But at the moment, it is a problem, whether it be the system or whether it's the assembly. So there's still a good amount of work to be done, but that's why I'm so keen that we get to the table. It's possible, so it's going to be tough.
It's interesting you say for non-GI people who are used to spreadsheets. I mean, I've just been writing a practical for people who've just done spreadsheets and are about to do ArcGIS, which I guess is a bit like jumping on a cliff instead of jumping off it, but it might also be like jumping off it. But, Was there a question in the middle there? Eddie, yeah.
I was going to ask about your point about digital engineers, since they've, well, tomorrow's graduates, a bit of what the role of the GI professional will be when the engineers are doing the GIS. And it's kind of looking at it, there's a whole raft of horrible maps that keep coming out where people have said, hey, I've done this amazing thing, this online tool, and they've forgotten the basic concepts of geography. So
yeah.
I see the role of tomorrow's GI professional to ensure best practice, but also GIS moves on, it's disseminating information over the web and integrating with HTML5, etc. So maybe that's what tomorrow's GI professional does.
I would agree with that. I think, thank you for giving me the opportunity to go back on that, because the CAD technicians, I think the difficulty was that all they were doing were producing drawings which were separated from the process of design. Now, I think for our GI graduates, what they need to do is a little bit what I've done, which is I've morphed into a BIM person, because then they would accept me as a part of the team. So, we will graduate still GI, absolutely, but it will be done within a relevant context, so that actually you will then be able to become a part of a multidisciplinary team. Your role will be able to actually facilitate cross-working, cross-collaboration, integrated decision-making. That's what you will be doing. So that it, what you'll be called, what the opportunity will be, I'm not quite sure whether digital, what we don't want is to create a BIM manager profession, because we don't want to perpetuate this thing of this information production separated from design and engineering decisions. We want actually the digital engineer, so literally the person who gives the digital information modeler. This is an unfortunate fact when you think about it, but that's a sort of that we're still trying to tussle about what the name will be. But there's definitely a profession which will be integrated and helping drive those decisions, that decision making. And it will be, big data again is another of these nonsense terms. It's all data. The fact that it's volume, so the way that we actually analyse it is beside the point. Still the process of what we need to do to help inform and support better decisions is the same as it's always been. But that data analysis and interpretation and how you visualise it and then support the people in making those decisions, I think it's going to be a critical role and an opportunity for us as professionals. Now there could well be other people who move into that space as well. And I think quite rightly too, mathematicians and so forth, but I think we can hold our own. Maybe actually some of us as GI professionals need to offer our mathematical skill.
Absolutely.
And I think that could be a challenge for the universities, is that some of the graduates will need to have a more mathematical skill than perhaps they have in the past.
Might it be the role within the environment of the data custodian, that the person who sits at the centre and makes sense of some of the data is where the geographers should be going?
Yeah, so that thing where I have the limit only BIM thing, is that sometimes you see that we should be in the centre.
That's right.
Actually orchestrating. So, the interesting thing is, if you read that McKinsey report, the CEO, is that, and when you look at it, geographers are actually moving into very senior spaces now, I think even more so, because that integration and understanding from a geographic perspective is going to become more and more important. I genuinely do think that. But if we can integrate that with an understanding of how to be able to manage and to analyse information and be able to support better conversations and dialogue, because that needs to happen before decisions to make, that would be massive. But I probably have said enough about the whole psychology and the different types of thinking, but if we can be doing that, thinking about that human-computer interface and how we can stimulate different thinking, whether it be that sort of more sensual pen to paper or intuition or gut side of things, you know, what makes us human should be a part of how we make decisions. And I think that's really exciting, a great challenge for us, that we could be doing that.
Interesting stuff. I think we might be approaching Geodrinks time. So if nobody really wants to know any more engineering acronyms.
I do have to have, what say, one more thing, because now I've put my piece of paper down, so somebody's going to have to correct me, because I believe on the 23rd of October there is another AGI focus event, which Ben's been sorting out, which is on mobile. Do you want to talk to us?
I can do, yeah, sure. So basically this is the first focus event that AGI is running, and it's going to focus on the events, yeah, on the 23rd of October, focusing on mobile data capture. We've got presentations for various sectors, consultancy and also forestry commission as well. It's an opportunity to come to the network and transfer knowledge, followed by, like tonight, Jerry Creeks as well.
And actually, that's just reminded me, forgive me for your question about our role as GI. There are some real cowboys coming in, you know, like with the mobile data capture side of things, and it's scary because, you know, the equipment's become cheap, so they think that they can do this. So, yeah, we'll have loads of point clouds floating in space without baseline surveys and so forth. So this is a really, really threatening and disruptive time at the moment. And, you know, being able to share best practice and make sure people are aware of the threats and the risks on mobile data capture is a really good example.
Wow. If I remember correctly, the 23rd of October is a Thursday.
It's
actually been there as well. Right, well, on that note, I'll just remind you again about the list at the door. So if anyone's interested in AGI announcements and AGI Scotland announcements, do sign up for that. So it just remains for me to say thank you all for coming, and final thing, we should just say thank you once again to Anne, who we were very fortunate to have come up and join us. So thank you indeed for a very interesting, fascinating talk. Thank you.